happens if we have our PD serving a warrant and they determine that there's dogs at that door and they need us there first to mitigate that threat, we are going in first, you know?
You never know what you're going to get in. You never know what type of animal is going to walk through the door.
We're tasked with knowing all these things, performing all these tasks, exposing ourselves to all these hazards at pay that really, really lags behind every other comparable position.
With these hoarding cases, you really have to become a social worker as an ACO.
When you're perceived as just the dog warden or somebody who plays with puppies at the animal shelter, why would we need a taser?
Welcome to Respond to Resilience. Along with Dr. Stacy Raymond and Bonnie Rummel, the LCSW EMT, I'm David Dashinger. In this episode, we'll be speaking with Jennifer Miranda. She's the Chief Animal Control Officer for the City of Bridgeport, Connecticut, and Gina Gambino. She's the Head Animal Control Officer for Monroe, Connecticut Police Department Animal Control Unit. We'll be talking about the evolving role of animal control officers, differences between being an urban and a rural or suburban animal control officer, and the impact that being an animal control officer can have on ACO professionals, affecting their personal and family well-being. We have a lot more besides that to talk about, and we are recording this during Animal Control Officer Appreciation Week, so we salute all those professionals out there doing an amazing job. We invite you to like and subscribe. Our YouTube channel is Respond to Resilience, Facebook, Respond to Wellness, Inc., and Respond to TV, LinkedIn, and all the podcast platforms. And check out our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. We'll be right back to speak with Jennifer and Gina right after this.
In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job.
In this family, up to a quarter of 911 telecommunicators have symptoms of post-traumatic stress.
In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis,
while responders are quietly suffering.
In this family, many struggle with job-related stress,
burnout, trauma, sleep disruptions, substance abuse,
and relationship problems.
In this family, we can help the helpers.
With vital information and resources,
resilience strategies,
and success stories of overcoming the obstacles.
In this family, no one is alone.
Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacy Raymond, and Bonnie Rimley, LCSW EMTB.
My name's Ray Connors. I am retired chief of the Animal Control Unit for the state of Connecticut. I was on the job for 34 years, and the last 10 years I was the chief of the unit. The great thing about the job was you never knew what was going to happen that day, so every day was a fresh day, so it never made the job boring. Animal control officers cover the full spectrum of anything from animal cruelty cases to handling stray dogs to public safety to mutual aid with other municipalities, especially in hoarding cases when there's hundreds of animals that have to be moved. So I invite you to sit back and enjoy this episode as you get to meet Jennifer Miranda and Gina Gambino, and both of these young animal control officers and the perils that they deal with in their job from day to day.
We'd like to welcome Jennifer and Gina here to the show. A little bit about them. Chief Animal Control Officer Jennifer Miranda has been serving the city of Bridgeport, Connecticut since March of 2016. She started volunteering at an animal shelter in middle school and has always pursued an interest in animal welfare. She studied at Becker College, received an associate's degree in animal care and behavior, and a bachelor's in criminal justice. Her role at Bridgeport Animal Control, Jennifer aims to balance effective, humane law enforcement with progressive, community-centered animal control and care policies. Gina Gambino has served multiple communities as both a municipal and regional animal control officer over the past 17 years. She currently holds the position as head animal control officer for the Monroe, Connecticut Police Department's Animal Control Unit, and she's been an assistant park ranger in Trumbull, Connecticut for the past 10 years. She's a 2019 recipient of the John Nowinski Community Champion Award and was a 2016 Wildlife and Crisis Animal Control Officer of the Year. She attributes her perseverance in her career to maintaining a sense of humor during tough times, always remembering where she came from and keeping the standards for her work and service high. Jennifer, Gina, warm welcome to Respond to Resilience.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
We were excited about this one. It's nice to see both of you.
Oh, it's really, really nice to be here. I was really happy to be asked. You know, a mutual friend of, I guess, all of ours, Ray Connors, reached out to me, and I was really excited to talk to him about it. And this seemed like a really awesome concept. So I'm happy to be here and participate. And I'm happy to see a familiar face with Gina, too.
Yes, it's good to see you, too, Jen. I think Ray is definitely a mutual friend of ours. It's important, I think, that we mention Ray because he is kind of the granddaddy of animal control, and realizing, I think, the wellness impact that animal control has on its employees and its officers. So I can definitely thank him for that, for hooking us up with this. So
nice. All right. So let's get started. I'd like to ask Jen first, looking back, is there a particular case or scene that impacts you to this day? And what about that scene may surprise the listeners?
So we're going to get right into it then. A fire in an outbuilding, what they were calling a smokehouse. And upon arrival, they realized not only were their dogs being kept outside in December, it was about like 38 degrees, just enough where it's not freezing, but it's still very cold. Two pit bulls in these outside runs. But the real reason for the call was that once they put out the fire, they realized that the individuals on scene were burning some sort of animal carcasses, which we determined ended up being three dogs, most likely at least two of them puppies. Yeah, absolutely. Ugh. We were called on scene not only to secure for scene safety, because we did have one pit bull that was loose, but also to retrieve the other one from the outdoor run. And it was then, you know, brought to our attention that, hey, we need to explore the smokehouse more and see what we could remove from in there. And they had been burning not only those carcasses, but animal excrement and household trash and waste. There was the remnants of a mattress in there. So we had wires, you know, poking up. So definitely something to be said for, you know, getting called out. It's nighttime, it's cold, and you're going to glove up and pick through this burned trash. And the smell will never really leave my nostrils. And I think that's true for a lot of animal control scenes, that people don't realize that we can absolutely identify a hoarding house from down the street. You know, we know what that smells like at this point.
Very identifiable smell for us.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, it's like I said, it doesn't leave your nostrils. It does, but like it definitely leaves a mark in your brain.
It burns into your memory forever.
Yeah.
Forever. Yeah. Mm.
And so you're on scene for something like that, and knowing that you have to conduct this investigation and take care of the evidence. You know, we get these animals transported up to Yukon for necropsy, and we have living evidence, which is something that is so unique to animal control, is that when we're on a scene and we're removing evidence, so often that evidence is alive and will require more than being stored in an evidence locker over at the PD. Yeah. It's going to require medical care. It's going to require constant photographing. It's going to require that those medical records are done effectively and thoroughly by the veterinarian you choose, which you don't always get to choose. So you need to be very on top of making sure that that evidence and those records are maintained in a way that does build a good case for you, because it can make it fall apart. And you are the orchestrator of all of that for a scene like that. It does come down to you. And then you're working cooperatively with your police and your fire departments. But when it comes to the management of that, like I said, living evidence, that's your responsibility as an ACO.
Wow.
Gina, the same question. I just want to ask you to add a dimension to that, if you could. And that's, you know, Jennifer's talking about a scene which sounds like almost a hazmat scene. What accommodations do you make in terms of entering a scene like that as an animal control officer for your personal safety?
So definitely for my personal safety, you have to definitely look around and see what the elements of the scene are. I remember specifically, definitely in Jenny's territory in Bridgeport, you know, you tend to approach a lot of hoarding situations that can quite prevalently present a health issue for you entering in. You're dealing with animal waste. You're dealing with dogs that can potentially harm you. You're dealing with situations, apartments that are so hoarded. They have rotting food. They have mold. They have once again those health issues that can really hurt you. So definitely, I think calling the proper resources to the scene. And once again, as Jenny said, making sure that you keep proper evidence in your case, making sure that you handle your animals appropriately. That's what's going to make or break a case for you.
Mm-hmm. At the core of every community beats the heart of its first responders, ever present on the front line, making the impossible look routine. Through the relentless pressure and the unseen scars, our frontline warriors silently battle the stress of the job. It's crucial they armor up mentally and emotionally, not just for the community they safeguard, but for the families they return to. Supporting the wellness and mental health of first responders is priority number one. By championing their well-being, we're ensuring they're unstoppable, both in the line of duty and in life. Step up for the titans who protect us, because when they're firing on all cylinders, they're not just first responders, they're game changers. Join us. Visit ResponderTV.com to be the difference.
I just wanted to add, I've dealt with a couple cases that really kind of hit me hard, more so earlier in my career. And one of them was situation on Goddard Avenue in Bridgeport. I think Jenny knows where that is. But there was a case that I handled that had 89 cats and dogs. And it really hit me when I saw chihuahuas coming out of that house with actual eyes missing, eyes falling out. It's really important to keep a straight head when when you're out on those scenes, because really it kind of impacts your coworkers. It impacts the other responders that are on scene, dealing with that as well. So
I had a question about that. How do you manage dealing with the suspects or the possible perpetrators of this neglect, abuse, hoard when you're holding a dog that is missing eyes or the eye is coming out, like you're saying? How do you handle those people? How can you find compassion and restraint and patience in that moment?
I think a big part of it is you have to keep reminding yourself, like, I swear in the back of my head, I'm chanting empathy, empathy, empathy. And it really does help to have the training on the hoarding situations and understand that hoarding in and of itself is a mental health condition.
Right.
When you're speaking to some of these, say perpetrators, but they're animal lovers, they're animal owners. When you're speaking to them, it becomes really clear that there's this effective sort of tunnel vision that starts to happen, at least in some of these cases, and a lot of the ones where it is very clearly someone with a mental health condition that got overwhelmed and then the animal numbers started building. Mm-hmm. And, when they are confronted more obviously, like, with us being on scene, with the scale and the intensity of the damage caused to the animals, to their home, to the environment, and they're kind of unfortunately forcefully ripped out of that tunnel vision, they do struggle. So it is really important. I think Gina had spoken to this, to call the right people in, make sure social services is there, make sure you have an officer to back you up too, because everybody processing a situation, I don't get upset if someone does process it in a way that is very angry. It is very hard for your entire worldview, your perspective of your life, to get flipped upside down, and then to have the things that you keep around you to comfort you, which in an animal hoarder's case is the 89 animals, to have those forcibly removed, it's it's a huge, huge mental health break for them. And while it needs to happen, and while it is absolutely necessary for the health of the animals and the environment and to the person themselves, it is very difficult for them to flip that switch. And they sometimes don't even have the tools to flip that switch. That's why they're in the situation in the first place. So having that background and that knowledge and being able to tell yourself, like, this person, in a lot of cases, there are absolutely cases where it is malicious and intentional, and you know, but with some of these where it really does affect you, because, you know, Gina said, like, the scene is dangerous to you, whether it's bug content like bed bugs and cockroaches, whether it's you can't get to the second floor because it isn't safe, it isn't weight bearing, all these things, you have to kind of keep in mind that a lot of times that kind of malice isn't there, and it really is, you're in there to help all of the living individuals in that situation, including the person that you would call a perpetrator, but it is the animal owner too.
Gina, do you want to add to that?
So definitely, you know, what Jenny just touched upon, a lot of times we see these animal owners as perpetrators, but a lot of times what they really are mental patients. With these hoarding cases, you really have to become a social worker as an ACO. You know, you have to be able to identify, you know, when to call in the right resources, social services, if there's a fire hazard, a safety issue on scene, you call in the fire marshal, you call in the health department if you're dealing with animal waste. It's so important, once again, to have those resources on scene.
I have another question about safety. Like, what if you walk into a scenario and there are multiple dogs? Like, do you have something like a taser? Or, like, and you could possibly be, you know, one's coming at you left, right, front, back. Like, what do you do to help yourself there when you can't get back into your vehicle? Like, what do you have to defend yourself?
The tools that animal control officers have are different in each town. We're each allowed to carry different items. So usually the common tools that animal control officers are given are expandable batons, pepper spray, capsaicin spray, to protect themselves against these animals. A lot of times also, animal control officers will carry tasers. That's a new and upcoming thing. Tasers, believe it or not, are quite effective in use on canines, larger canines. And I have carried one before. I think it's a great idea. But also, you know, when you mention that, when you mention what can animal control officers use to protect themselves, there's a cost aspect for your department. It definitely costs money to outfit your animal control officers and keep your animal controls resourced with these items. So, you know, that is sometimes a conflict.
As Gina said, it is not consistent from municipality to municipality. So I'm in Bridgeport. Gina has served Bridgeport. We have our radios. We have a catch pole, and that is what we have. You know, we've done training for OC spray. We've done training for baton. She also mentioned, like, that cost effect. There's also the idea that training does, you know, expire in a sense, or staff does turn over, and then you do have to obviously redo that training with new staff. It is not something that is consistent across the board, and it is a conversation that we have amongst ourselves as ACOs in the state. You know, you'll have one ACO pop up and say, hey, you know, does anybody carry? Can you tell me about your policy for that? Are you able to send me a policy? Because we're all trying to share this information to improve our profession and keep ourselves safe, because I think it is something where perception doesn't align with the reality of the job, of the position, when we're perceived as just dog catchers. Well, why would you need something besides a catch pole? When you're perceived as just the dog warden, or somebody who plays with puppies at the animal shelter, which when we get to, we absolutely do, but that is not by and large the majority of our position. Why would we need a taser, as Gina said? Why would we need OC spray. But the fact is if we have our PD serving a warrant and they determine that there's dogs at that door and they need us there first to mitigate that threat, we're going in first, you know?
Oh, wow.
So and there's a big misunderstanding as to the type of danger that we are exposed to on the job. We're knocking on the same doors the police are knocking on.
Right.
They're going to react to
you're
us.
In the same environment. You're exposed to the same environment as any yes. police officer responding yes. to any other household mm-hmm. would. I do think that there's a lot of miscommunication and a lot of misguidance and, you know, understanding what our job is, as Jenny just said.
Do you wear a vest?
I do not depends personally wear a vest.
Okay.
Yeah, me neither.
Yeah. So I'm thinking of you going in first. Gee. Wow.
Well, okay. I was going to say, it strikes us that you're forgotten first responders. You know, it's like people... I think people know generally what police do, but like you said, they think of animal control as holding puppies and, oh, let me shepherd you to the dog pound. But there's so much more involved, and you're on the same scenes, taking the same risks alongside your brothers and sisters in law enforcement. And so I think the both of you debunking that misnomer is super important.
I think, you know, like we were mentioned, our mutual friend, Ray Connors before, he's also a huge proponent that ACOs are first responders. Mm-hmm. But until we are able to reach a common definition, and this would be, I think, at the state sort of legislative level of like, ACOs are considered, are we sworn? Are we considered first responders? Are we considered essential? How are we going to actually define this in statute to allow ACOs to feel comfortable within their roles, especially if you do end up, I've been with Bridgeport for a very long time, but if I wanted to move from town to town, those policies are going to change yeah. with each town I go to, and I'm going to have to adjust. It isn't as easy as going like, I went to the State Academy and I am a certified, licensed Connecticut State ACO, so I can be inserted basically anywhere. It mm-hmm. really does inhibit that kind of movement. And I'm not saying that you necessarily want all that type of movement. But if I want to go from one place to another, I'm going to adjust to a completely different definition of what I am in my role. And I feel like with such a small state, we should be able to get on the same page.
Yeah.
I agree. Definitely. It's going to have to come from up above. It's going to have to come from legislature. It's going to have to be written into law. A lot of the progressions in animal control safety that needs to happen, it's needed. It's definitely a safety issue, and it's definitely kind of a surprise, just as Jenny said, how slow of a roll it's been to develop this. Mm-hmm. You know, I really do see it as not just, you know, a danger for ourselves, but also kind of a liability for our towns or government agencies to have individuals walking around without a lot of the resources, a lot of the protection that they need.
Sure.
You know, that has to be discussed.
And that's our first responder community, man. We do amazing things for other people at the risk of ever doing anything amazing for ourselves.
Knowing that we have additional stressors, that means we have to take on the responsibility of making ourselves more resilient.
And on game day, we must succeed as a team. When one of us succeeds, we all succeed.
Most superhero origin stories, they're all stories of post-traumatic growth. You're like the Hulk that's been exposed to gamma radiation, and now you have this super ability because of that trauma you've experienced.
Before you became a firefighter, paramedic, and EMT, whatever it is, you were a human. You started off as a human. That human's got to be taken care of, and then we can take care of other people.
Gina, I would love to have you weigh in on this because you've got a very unique perspective. And that's talk a little bit about the unique differences between being a urban versus suburban or rural ACO. What are the things that have come into your experience that people should know about.
So, you know, as I worked in kind of urban environments, more so lower Fairfield County, you know, I have a saying that's it's 10 pounds of manure in a 5-pound bag, you know, for lack of a more eloquent term. So you definitely have more call volumes. You definitely have those nooks and crannies and crevices where a lot of animal cruelty, a lot of neglect can hide. You have populations of people that are, you know, so jammed together than what you would deal with in a suburban or rural environment. Both jobs are quite different. But with those different communities, urban versus suburban, you have different responsibilities. You have different hats that you have to wear as an animal control officer. A lot of the larger towns, a lot of the larger shelters, so to speak, they have kennel keepers. They do have people who definitely have to attend to animals that are being kept in these large volume shelters. There's no getting out of it. You have to hire staff that can pay attention to those populations of animals. More so in a lot of the rural or suburban environments, you end up being an ACO that handles a lot of hats. It wears a lot of hats, essentially. Not only are you, you know, that ACO that's going out on calls, you're also responsible for caring for your animals, making sure that your animals are healthy. You're handling your own budgets. You're doing a lot of your own paperwork. Regional ACOs, a lot of ACOs that don't report to police departments, they are communicating with the state about all the tickets that they write out. They're sending in the information back and forth, responding to FOI requests. So it's a lot. It's definitely very much of a contrast in both the urban environment and the suburban environment. I found you know, there's definitely an equal responsibility that the towns ask of their employees. It can be quite stressful at times. In animal control, I really do feel what we deal with is a lot of life, concentrated life in sharp bursts. And, you know, I think the same goes for the, you know, the responsibilities that are involved as well. You know, medicating a dog, taking 15 minutes to medicate a dog, you know, in the interim of going out on a call that you've been asked to take, we don't always think about that. We don't always account for that as something that we've done as a task in our mind through the day. It adds up. Little things like that, you know, add up.
So, to that end, what do you both do to mitigate the psychological impact of all of this?
So it's definitely important to have hobbies. It's definitely important to induct a sense of self-care. When you are an animal control officer, I ride horses. so once again, that's another animal-based hobby, but it's right up my alley. I do have a horse. I board him up in Southbury. I'm up there every weekend. I'm up there during the week. And that helps to keep me healthy. That's my escape. That's my mental escape. I've also found connecting with your peers really is a healthy thing. Connecting with peers, just like Responder Wellness, connecting with you guys definitely does help. Talking about how we can make our profession better. It's not only just going to help your profession, it's also going to help you. You have to be your own advocate in this game. So
it really is a daily check-in with yourself. And I'll be the first to admit that I should be better at this. There have been...
It's okay. We're all busy.
I know, right? There's absolutely ups and downs to our experiences. I can have a very, very good day at work and really go home going like, I could do this for 35 more years. And I can have a day where I need to go home and all I want is sleep for dinner and to totally check out for a little bit.
I have those days too. We all have that. Right. And you know what I find that keeps me going in this profession, you know, you do have quite a few bad days, you know, that you're going to deal with in any first responder profession. It's important to find a sense of meaning in what you're doing. I find that that's what really keeps me going in this job. I have good days and I have bad days, but you know, you go home. Do you feel satisfied with what you did? That is the question that I answer in the back of my mind. Most days I can say yes. Most days I do the best I can.
Yeah. Jennifer, do you have other self-care tools, or is there a peer network that you you work with or are part of that helps you with support?
I'm a little less, honestly, as a human, a little less social, a little less peer group. I am much more like an individual sort of speaker, with one big exception, and that's our social media on Facebook for our page. And you know, it's a double-edged sword, because of course that means I have to be on and be ready to respond to a lot more people. But it has connected me with some really brilliant people, including other ACOs from different parts of the state that I wouldn't have a chance to interact with, like, organically. And including just really, really wonderful pet owners, previous adopters, adjacent sort of organizations like the Kathy Kangas Foundation. And it really is something to be said that, like, you can be having a day, in like all caps. And when you're building those like individual connections, you will just get like a text from somebody going like, oh, I saw this, or I saw you're doing this, is such a good idea, or I saw this dog got adopted, congrats. And it really does make a difference. But like I said, I'm not the most extroverted, most like social person to recharge my battery. I think I'm the opposite, where I am very much, I like to be with myself. And I think unique to a lot of our animal control officers and people working in animal welfare, that does include animals in my bubble. So a lot of times what I'll do, and I really felt what Gina said about like, do you leave satisfied, is I'll go back in the kennels and I'll pick a dog and I'll sit down and I'll work with that dog for a little while. I'll get them outside. We'll do a little bit of training. We'll do a little bit of, you know, confidence building and everything for a dog that really kind of is falling behind or needs it. And seeing that like before and after, she had said like that satisfaction that like, did I do something today? It's like, even if, and this is something that I think we all contend with, that the issues that we're having in animal sheltering and animal control right now are so far and beyond what one person can effectively handle themselves. And yet we do get this kind of burden put on our shoulders. I can't fix all of that, but I can make that animal have a good day. Or I can make this person have a good day by being able to help them with like a food pantry or something like that. And so if I can take just like the little win and take that home with me, like the many, many things we take home with us, I'd like to add more of that and less of the harsh realities that do come with it.
So important to focus on what you can change in animal control versus what you can't change. It's very much of a profession where you have to pick your battles, especially in your environment, Jenny, you know.
For sure, but we're winning, I think. Maybe.
So is it the wins that make you come back to work each day, ready to start again? What does make you come back? Because it sounds like there's a lot of pain to deal with too.
It's the wins. I think it's the conviction to want to change and do good. Not just for your profession, but also for your communities. It's the conviction to want to make a difference. That's what really keeps me coming back every single day. I am an INFJ. That is my personality type, to the best of my knowledge. And I really am the type of person that I really want to make a difference. I really want to, I strive, to set goals, every day that I want to accomplish.
So if you could wave a wand, I was wondering, Jennifer, maybe you can start with this one, but okay. If we all had that magic wand in our world, how different, but what would the future of animal control and animal sheltering look like if you had that wand?
I think there's two parts to that, and it's, you know, within our animal shelter itself, our animal control unit ourselves, like what would I change, and then what would I change external to that to make it better? So if I were to, like you said, I am a fairy and I can wave my wand. I would make sure that we are consistent across the board. Are we first responders? Are we sworn? Like we had talked about, give us all some really solid ground to stand on. And give us some equality across the board so that we are able to work together more effectively. I would give us more access to training. I would give us a better understanding of what we do so that when we ask for more staff or we ask for materials or safety equipment, it isn't like, well, do you need this? Because there's this misconception or this town doesn't have it or this town does. Being able to have that seat at the table and know that seat is going to stay at the table because we are respected as, you know, first responders. We are respected as very major players in this investigative status that we have amongst our police departments in, you know, investigating animal cruelty scenes. And then externally, when we see the strains and the pressures that animal control and animal sheltering are going through right now, I would, again, this is a magic wand, right? free spay neuter everywhere. And I know that vets can't do that. I know that's not something that is, this is, we're talking a magic wand, but very accessible, very affordable spay neuter across the board so that our shelters aren't overfilling. You know, accessible tools for pet owners that help them to be responsible pet owners so that we're not ending up with situations where people are overwhelmed and unable to provide care or people are making poor decisions in which pet they're obtaining. So, you know, no impulse purchases of like small animals like reptiles, which is like a big deal for me. Really, really love them. And they're really left behind when we talk about abuse. They're highly abused animals, thus small animals and the reptiles. Again, that's if I had a magic wand. But to reduce those pressures coming from the outside and to absolutely arm up on the inside and really feel ready to face it. If we could have both of those happening concurrently, I think we would be in animal control utopia.
Well, my goals definitely are very similar to what Jenny has spoken about. I really do feel that animal control needs to be standardized once again, starting with legislation. I do feel that there needs to be an across all the board standardization of responsibilities of an animal control officer, tools and resources to keep us safe. Once again, training. Yes, those are all things that need to come into play. Spay neuter, definitely. You know, coming up with some sort of probably government funded program would most definitely help with that.
Sure.
Well, I can speak to this from personal experience here where I live in Florida. Jen, talk about the state of the number of animals in shelters in Connecticut. Is it in crisis proportions? And what do people need to know about that?
So, I mean, absolutely. And it's a real misconception that if we can just move animals up north, that there's just endless amounts of homes up here and people looking for these animals. So animal importation has become something that has reached a crisis point. And now we're seeing, and this is multiple things. This is animal importation. This is lack of spay neuter. This is rising costs of care. But we're seeing these animals flooding into shelters and flooding into shelters in ways that I don't know how to put this eloquently, they're worse. You know, we're seeing so many more articles of animals abandoned in highly neglected medical conditions. And it's every week. You know, I see another one pop up. It's like Hartford just had it. Woodbridge just had it. You see, you know, the pictures of these animals, and it's happening over and over and over again. And it's tough because a lot of the things that we were doing that were so effective, whether it was social media or adoption events or doing our rabies clinics or everything, and it kept our numbers low in the shelter. And we were really starting to see that positive change, and we were really getting there. And there was a reason people wanted to send animals up north, and it's because we were rocking it, right?
Yeah.
We're doing that, and we're working harder at it just to barely tread water now. And it's
impacted our region of the country from being as efficient and being as effective in handling animal crises as positive as we used to. So
it's almost like you get punished for doing a good job, right? So you, if the Northeast is doing a great job, here's more.
Yeah. exactly.
Wow.
And you want to help. And I'm not saying that these southern shelters aren't also overflowing and that these island shelters aren't also overflowing. They absolutely are. The problems exist there too. I am not denying that. But what I'm saying is when your plane is going down, you put your mask on first. If we don't have our masks on and our shelters are overflowing with just animals that have originated in Connecticut that are entering kind of a rehoming arena, whether they're being posted on Facebook, I need to get rid of my dog, whether they're being dumped on the streets and they're flooding into shelters, whether they're calling, which is what you should do, but calling rescue groups and saying, I need to rehome my pet because of A, B, and C. And now the rescues are overflowing. Well, now they're not pulling from animal shelters. These systems that we've had in place that have kept our numbers at a point where it's very manageable, those systems are now so overloaded and so strained, they're smoking. And they're going to be on fire soon. So what we're trying to do with this, and this is something that I've been really trying to work on, is it doesn't work to continue on as if this is not happening and to just keep accepting that burden and going, well, I guess this is just my problem now and I just have to fix it all by myself with zero awareness while these things keep happening. The community wants to see animal shelters do well. The community loves animals. But if they don't know that certain actions are contributing to this crisis in Connecticut and if they don't know how to help and you don't tell them that you need help, you pretend everything's fine, well, then things aren't going to change. And I think we're at the point where it is not a bad thing to acknowledge that this is happening. It is not talking down on anybody on any one community to go, hey, we're experiencing an extremely high volume of abandoned pets or extremely high volume of high medical need abandoned pets. What can we do to start to try to fix this? That's not speaking in a negative term. It's going, hey, I see that we're going to be running into this. What can we do to work together to fix it? And I think that if we're not proactive, us being reactive is not going to look the way everybody wants it to. And nobody wants to do that because we have done so well in Connecticut with, you know, our spay neuter, and we've done so well in Connecticut with low euthanasia rates in shelters. And we've just really established ourselves as being a very humane state. But if you put us under the same conditions as a southern state, experiencing those same things, but you expect a different outcome for us, then we're going to need more resources and we're going to need some help.
I think what's really affected us up in the northeastern portion of the country, I just really want to talk about this, is COVID. COVID really reshuffled a lot of things in our country, especially animal control as a profession, especially the animal care industry as a profession. And guess what? It's also affected our mental health. I think it's affected a lot of people's mental health and family life in our region. I think that's something that has been a little bit taboo for people to talk about, not just in animal control, but just as society as a whole. It really has affected us in the Northeast, just the way that the ability that people are able to care for their pets. That has also caused a bog down as well. I really think that needs to be a discussion.
Do you think there was like a rush of people to adopt pets because they're you know, they're now working from home, they're in lockdown or whatever, and so they're lonely. And so absolutely. Do you think that there was like a rush? That was my thought, that
absolutely the adopted. I think there was pets. A rush, but I think.
And now also, they can't handle it, or they have to go back to
I
work.
I don't think that's 100% it, though. No? They didn't all return all of their adopted COVID pets in one big wave, because it is partially COVID, but in our post-COVID world, uh-huh. how much else has changed? Inflation is supposedly only at whatever percent.
Absolutely.
And yet
cost of
the
food.
Prices, so, veterinary prices have gone up. What I also think is that you know, schedules, people's schedules, the way that they conduct life has really changed. It's a number of different factors. Life altogether as a whole after COVID has really been different. And the animals, unfortunately, animals were last priority to begin with. I really do feel that post that era, they're more so last on the list.
Responder Resilience is your place for insightful discussions for emergency services professionals, including law enforcement, EMS, fire service, 911 telecommunicators, animal control, rescue squads, K-9 officers, corrections, trauma-informed therapists, and agency leaders. We bring you leading experts and influencers in emergency services, sharing knowledge and tools to improve the culture of wellness and to inspire excellence in leadership. Tune in live every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time for the weekly premiere on YouTube and Facebook. Or stream episodes anytime on ResponderTV.com or on your favorite podcast platform. Stay current with hot topics, informative content, and get valuable insights on how to lead a healthier life both on and off the job by subscribing to us on YouTube and Facebook. Responder Resilience is committed to our family of public safety professionals. Remember to like and subscribe today.
Well, as we start to wrap up, I'd like to float this question. We'll start with Gina. What would you like first responders, law enforcement, fire, EMS, anyone that you co-respond with, what would you like them to know about your job and your role that would kind of help you work better together?
So I think it's important to know that animal control is a real profession. It's not just about cuddling kittens and puppies. I think a lot of people from the outside are very misinformed as to what we do.
Yeah.
A lot of our departments, a lot of our towns are very misinformed as to what our job responsibilities are. I recently had to explain to some outsiders that our main responsibility is not always to handle wildlife. Actually, statutorily, handling wildlife is not our job at all, really, in Connecticut. We enforce chapters 435 of the Connecticut General Statutes, and that pertains to the care of domestic animals. Animal control officers have additionally, by social standards, been tasked with handling a lot of other accessory tasks to go along with that. So, you know, once again, we are employees of many hats. Once again, it is a job of handling 10 things at once on any given day, and any given day looking completely different from the last. So you never know what you're going to get in. You never know what type of animal is going to walk through the door. It's just that. It's just as crazy as any other profession. So,
well, Jennifer, I'd love for you to add your thoughts to that. I mean, you guys, you know, just hearing you speak today, you're versatility and skill set is immense to do that job. So what would you like other first responders to know about co-responding?
I mean, not just first responders, but, you know, the municipalities we work in, because it is really a Venn diagram, whether I'm going out to respond to an issue with a police officer, somebody from the fire department, somebody from the, you know, city in the sense of social services or elderly services. But understanding that, this position is a skilled position. It is not a position that I consider to be purely entry level. And when you, as Gina said, when you're tasked with wearing so many different hats, that does come with training, that does come with different backgrounds and adding different skills to the basket. And yet we, when we're treated as like an unskilled position or an entry level, as many communities still do, we're tasked with knowing all these things, performing all these tasks, exposing ourselves to all these hazards at pay that really, really lags behind every other, even sort of comparable position, when we are expected to attend a state academy, pass it, and then maintain our training, when we are expected to not only break our bodies. It is such a physical position. We were kind of talking about that before we started today, how physical this job is. But and
in
then
my
also,
town, I actually have to pick up deer. I have to pick up deer off the side of the road as one of my responsibilities. And yes, this job can definitely be taxing on you physically. You know, it's important definitely to induct self-care. You need to keep, you know, physically fit in order
you mean
to keep
pick them up and put them in your vehicle when they're dead.
So yes, we do. We do have to collect them. You know, but I think an important aspect of understanding animal control is that just as well as dealing with the living, you're also dealing with the dead. You know, that is one of the things that we have to see, in this profession. And, a lot of times also in the small towns.
Such an amazing conversation today. We could easily go on for a couple more hours and perhaps we'll circle back. But before we completely wrap up, Jennifer, please share with the audience where you can be reached, social media, website, any contact information you'd like to share.
Sure. So I'm at Bridgeport Animal Control. Our best point of contact through social media would be Facebook. So it's just facebook.com/BPT Animal Shelter. You can also reach us by email at animal.shelter@bridgeportct.gov and phone at 203-576-7727. We're there Monday through Saturday, 8 to 4 every week in the office. So definitely give us a shout, give us a follow. We're always looking for new ways to reach out to the community and get them involved in the things that we care about. And of course, get our pets available for adoption out into homes. So you can definitely tune in when we do live videos and we show off our pets. We're always happy to meet new people, even if that meeting is virtual. So definitely reach out. If you enjoyed the podcast, let us know. We would really like to, you know, keep talking about what we're talking about. It is so important to us to create awareness as to what we're doing as animal control officers. So thanks for having me. And hopefully we'll meet some new people soon.
Great. Gina, your contact and social.
Okay. Well, you can find me at Monroe, Connecticut Animal Control on Facebook. You can also find us at the Town of Monroe website. I can be reached by telephone 203-452-3760. That's our field office. And you can also reach me through the police department as well. You know, we have animals for adoption as well. If you're interested in adopting an animal, we can also make referrals to you as well.
Wonderful. Bonnie, do you have any closing thoughts on our conversation today?
Yeah, I feel every time we have someone related to animal control, especially, I learn so much because yes, in EMS, I was alongside them on certain calls, especially the hoarding scenes, which are, they're taxing on everyone because You know the psychology of the owners. It's very, very complicated on many levels. And I totally have felt that. But I always learn and I always just come away with a lot of respect for what you do. And I thank you for doing it because we need you there. We need more of you, but we need you. So thank you for doing what you do.
So my take is that, I think it requires a tremendous amount of emotional strength. Like my heart was breaking with some of the stories that you're talking about. I don't think I could become an animal control officer because it would just, it seems in some ways very painful. But as you said, you look for, you know, how you can make a difference. And, you know, if you've improved the life of an animal, then you should go to bed at night feeling like you've made a difference.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think in this job, it's important to recognize the good that you do on a daily basis. I get people that approach me all the time. They say, I don't know how you can do this job. I don't know how you can do this job every day. And my response to that is think of the people that are not suitable for the job that could be in your position. It's honestly your best asset to care about your job that can push you forward and keep you going every single day. So my response to those people is I do what I do as a profession, just to make sure that things are done right. And to make sure that the wrong people are not doing the job.
Right.
Well, clearly you are both rock stars doing this job, and your communities are blessed to have you in that position. So thank you for all you do, and thank you for being with us today, sharing all this great information, and we've all learned a lot today. So it's been an absolute pleasure having you on, and keep doing what you're doing. The world needs you.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
I'd like to remind you to check out our YouTube channel, Responder Resilience. You can like us on Facebook, Responder Wellness Inc., and Responder TV, LinkedIn, and all the podcast platforms. And go to our website, respondertv.com, for past episodes and guest information. Till the next time, stay safe, be kind to yourself, take care.